on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 89-year-old Dave Wall of Reedley, California. Last fall, he got to visit the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. on the inaugural Central Valley Honor Flight. His guardian on that flight was his nephew, Sam Wall, and they have pretty parallel stories. Both of them medics, one in World War II, one in Vietnam. Both Purple Heart recipients. We're going to hear from Sam, too, before we're done. And you can find a photo of this dynamic duo on hometownheroesradio.com or, of course, on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Let's get back to Dave's story right now. 19 years old, when you got that first taste of combat, you told us the story of being sent to retrieve enemy wounded, only to find out there weren't any. They'd all been killed. But I'm sure it wasn't long there in the Philippines before you had some of your own 24th Infantry brethren to try to patch up.
When we went up and asked for the wounded enemy, it was almost immediately one of our guys got hit. So we picked him up and took him back to the aid station. So I was picking up wounded from the time I got on the beach.
Was that pretty much a dawn to dusk duty?
Well, the war that I was familiar with wasn't that way. In other words, in our case, we would be fired on and then the enemy retreated, and we would advance until we found him again. And when we found him is when the shooting went on. Otherwise, there were days on end when I didn't do anything other than march. I say march, walk following the enemy. And when the shooting was on, naturally everybody keeps their head down as much as possible. It was a little more difficult for those of us that are medics because, we had to be up and moving about. So that kind of paints a picture of an aid man or a litter bearer. The troops all around you might very well be pretty close to the ground, but you were standing or walking or near standing position to get to where you had to go.
I know that you're an emotional guy, and I'm just wondering what kind of emotions you dealt with when you're caring for these guys who've been hit and how you handled the condition that you'd find them in.
During that time, I'm going to say I kind of shut off my emotions. And I didn't have any feeling. I won't say I didn't have any feeling. Naturally, I felt for the guy that was wounded, but I didn't ache for him.
You just wouldn't let yourself go there.
I wouldn't let myself get involved in people problems, no.
I don't want to get into all the guts and gore and just for the sake of doing so, but so we understand what you were dealing with. Can you give us a sense of what kind of injuries you saw, what kind of shape some of these soldiers were in that you had to get back to the aid station?
Yes. Okay. Other than outright dead, I guess I saw every kind of wound that there was. A lot of legs and arms and main body. And it was pretty messy. But like I say, I totally had no feelings. And I have trouble understanding for myself now because it didn't bother me. I wouldn't let it bother me.
And I know there's a lot of physical assistance you're providing and you're tying tourniquets or you're bandaging things up and obviously you're carrying guys back. What about conversations with these guys? Was there anything you could do to try to reassure them or console them?
No, there was very little conversation. I would say the main comment, if the guy was conscious and knew what was going on, was get me out of here. And he really didn't care that the litter ride was bumpy. He wanted to get out of that location where he was possibly still within the enemy fire.
And you shared how it kind of went in waves and you'd pursue the enemy and then you'd have another wave of casualties and like that. I guess I'm, again, just trying to imagine being in your shoes, and for some reason I imagine that you would hear someone calling out, medic, medic, quite often. I mean, could you keep up with the number of medic calls that were there?
That's an interesting comment because I think the most feared sound for a medic was that loud whisper that he didn't want anybody else to hear, but he wanted us to hear, medic, hey medic, hey medic, over here. Yes, and the 24th Division, and I mentioned I was a litter bearer, an aid man. Normally there's one aid man with each company, and their experience in New Guinea had been that moving the patient from the where he became a casualty back to the aid station was the biggest bottleneck. So they had us guys on detached service. I was on detached service throughout the war. I was with either 1st, 2nd, or 3rd Battalion, depending on which one was going to be in action.
So in other words, reading between those lines, some of those guys get a little day off or away from the front lines, and you're on the front lines regardless of who's out there with you.
That's really more or less the truth. It isn't as if I was doing this every day, because there were days on end when we wasn't involved in any kind of action. But yeah, it was pretty constant, and there were a lot of casualties, and I don't want to mention numbers because I don't remember them. I don't know. But I remember some things I learned about myself, about my capabilities and my limitations and so forth and so on. By rights, the aid man was supposed to have gotten to the casualty before we did, but very often it didn't happen. And very often we would intentionally move the patient before any first aid, get him back to the aid station with the battalion surgeon. The main thing to us was to get him out of there.
You shared earlier what some of your concerns were. Did you start to feel a concern or a fear that, hey, I'm out here and there's a lot of stuff flying around, I might get hit one of these days?
Yes, this was a positive thought. And I remember as the war went on, I think all of us recognized that the old-timers tended to get picked off sooner or later. And I honestly worried whether I would make that trip back to California that I so hoped for. And then there was the one time when I was nicked by a bullet. After we landed on the Isle of Leyte, the first day, we landed in the early morning. By mid-afternoon, we got word that MacArthur was coming ashore, so a couple of us went back to the beach and watched him wait ashore. He came in on an LCT, landing craft tank, which was a little larger than the rest of us troops were on.
Were you guys on LCVPs, or what'd you hit the shore on?
The LCVP was our to the beach.
So this is, you know, MacArthur, when he left the Philippines, had famously said, I shall return. And this is his triumphant return that's been photographed waiting in on Leyte there.
That is exactly true. I watched him wade ashore and come up to the newsreel camera, which there was a newsreel camera there. And he made his famous speech, people of the Philippines, I have returned.
And you were how far away?
Two or three arms distance. I was behind the cameraman, in the area right behind the cameraman, and I saw his lip quiver. So I knew that there were feelings there. There were feelings there. Then after MacArthur came ashore, that was our first day. Then it was on the ninth day when the four of us went to pick up this casualty, and we had picked him up and set him on the litter. And then as I moved around to my corner of the litter, I made the mistake of standing to my full 5 feet, 8.5 inches. And pow, I was knocked flat to my back. And there I found myself with my hands over the sternum. Now, naturally, I thought about that lecture, dead or bleeding to death. And I didn't think I was dead. I didn't feel, as a matter of fact, that I was seriously wounded. So I removed my hands and found a groove across the sternum. Now, recognizing that had my body been turned one way or the other, I very likely would have been a dead man.
So in your training, you'd gotten this lecture that you weren't even paying attention to until you heard the Bible verse, but you pay attention, and he says, if anything penetrates the sternum, don't bother with it, that guy's a goner.
That's
and
right.
And now, you're what, a fraction of an inch away from something penetrating your sternum?
Well, a fraction of an inch, yes. What can I say? It appeared later that this may have ricocheted slightly. It may have changed the direction. I think that I got the shoulder of the bullet versus the tip. And I think had I gotten the tip of the bullet, I'm a dead man.
So in other words, it came straight across your chest, but didn't penetrate far enough.
That's right, exactly. People tell me I was extra, extra lucky at that time. But I say, well, yes, unless you believe like I do that there was divine intervention. And this is simply the long and the short of it. I had my own private miracle, which I carry with me today.
You have that perspective today, and you just said that. You carry with it today. Is that how you felt at that moment? I mean, did it hit you right away that's what had happened?
As a matter of fact, no. I, as a matter of fact, thought I was just one of the lucky guys, you know. And there were other experiences like that, but none quite as dramatic. And in each instance, I thought, boy, was I lucky I escaped again. I really didn't recognize and realize what was going on. No. I didn't think of it at the time as being divine intervention. I thought of it as being a lucky hombre.
What changed your mind? Because you look pretty convinced of it now.
Well, I think the years that have gone by did it to me. Now, obviously, I'm a lot older now than I was then. And the years and realizing what happened, and it has been called back to my attention.
How serious were you hurt? Did it take you out of action for a while?
As a matter of fact, no. When I saw that it wasn't serious, I jumped to my feet and grabbed the litter, and we made tracks down to the battalion aid station. And I did do this. When the ambulance came to pick up this party, I went with the ambulance back to my company. And for the next week or so, all I did was unload ambulance or goof around or didn't do much of anything during that time.
You had a flesh wound that had to heal on your chest?
Yes, it was kind of laughable. It wasn't that serious, you know. So there's a little flesh wound, a little bleeding. So what?
Well, it was enough for them to award you the Purple Heart. Yes. So it wasn't insignificant. But it sounds like you weren't looking for an excuse to get out of action, that you wanted to continue doing what you were doing. Why was that?
Well, I wouldn't say I wanted to, but when they said, let's go, we went. And that is the way with the military. When they say frog, you jump. And it was that simple. When they woke me, I was in a foxhole. And he said, get your stuff together because you're going out. He said, first go down to the mess hall and have your breakfast. So we did. The eight of us that were on detached service had breakfast before we got on the ship and went on the next mission.
And where'd you go from there?
The next mission took us around the other side of the island. And then we went back up through the boonies. There were no roads, no airports, no rivers to go on. And the riflemen hadn't had breakfast. But we were assured that we would be followed by a group of Filipino carriers that would bring us our rations. And this was on a Friday, as I recall. We marched and marched until noontime, always looking back, still no carriers. We marched until evening, still looked back and still no carriers. And then Saturday, we marched and marched till noon and no carriers, until evening and no carriers. Sunday morning, still no food. And we walked till noon, and by then the troops were all pretty tired, and we were not in shape to go on, really. And I guess our commanding officer got somebody on the hose. And within, I'd say, 45 minutes, a couple of C-47s with our biscuit bombers came by and dropped the rations to us. And then we had field rations from then on. Then we went on, took this position up on the hills. There were four hills where we took our positions. We were overlooking what was known as the Ormoc Corridor, and the Ormoc Corridor was the last place the enemy could still get to the ocean and get resupplied or get off the island. So we were told to hold our position there at all cost, and we were up there for 31 days. And during that time, we brought the casualties to the battalion aid station, which was us. And then we got the Filipino carriers each day bringing in rations and ammo and carrying the wounded back out. So we were there for 31 days. And incidentally, the battalion got a presidential citation for that particular mission.
Well, and you kind of nonchalantly threw out that your orders were to hold at all costs. But that is a pretty tall order. And there were a lot of places where people who got that order paid a really heavy cost, and I imagine there were some significant casualties there. Is there something else that enters your mind, or a next level of motivation, do you think, occurs when you get that order, hold at all costs? Because that's not a maybe, that's a pretty absolute.
I think I thought of it much like any other orders that I got. So we hold our position, you know, and we did, and it was uncomfortable, but you know, what can I say?
And you mentioned earlier how you didn't let some of the emotions get to you. But do you look back at it now and see what you did and say, how in the world did I keep going and going and going and going?
That is a thought. And like I say, at the time, my emotions were totally shut off. Yes, I wonder how I did it. I wonder how I did it and why I did it.
Even if you weren't allowing yourself to get too close to some of these guys, I imagine you developed an impression of the kind of people these were. What do you think we need to understand about the kind of people that were over there fighting for freedom?
Okay, that's a good question. We were people. We were no different than anybody else. Young people, to be sure.
When this fighting's going on, when you're wounded and all this is happening, to put it in context, you're, what, 19 years old?
Yes, I was 19, turned 20 at that time, and I was home and got my discharge the day before my 21st birthday. So I was in at 18 and out at 20 at 21. Now I see 21-year-old kids and 18-year-old kids, and I think, these are kids. But to me, at the time, I thought I was as capable as anybody else, and probably I was for what I had to do.
Well, you got the job done, and we're not done just yet. More from Dave when we come back, and we'll hear as well from a Vietnam veteran with a Silver Star and two Purple Hearts. It's Dave's nephew, Sam Wall. The rest of Hometown Heroes comes your way right after this.